Okay, so we had been discussing the fact that there is no defined length, quantitative sense, to the sentence of a Rotzeach Bishgaga in the Eir Miklat, the accidental murderer in the City of Refuge, but his release is linked to the passing of the Kohen Gadol, who was in office at the time of the sentencing. Again, a Kohen Gadol comes into office after the sentencing is not linked to this particular individual, the accidental murderer, and we were struggling with two different explanations as to why there should be a linkage. One of them sort of puts the onus on the Kohen and says the Kohen is responsible to pray on behalf of the people, on behalf of the nation, that such things shouldn't occur, and so it's a reflection on his leadership. But of course, that was difficult in the sense if you have a Kohen who just entered the office and hasn't had the opportunity to express that kind of national spiritual leadership, and 5 minutes later, the Rotzeach Bishgaga is sentenced to exile. Why exactly would that Kohen be punished? And the Gemara has a very fascinating solution, that he should have prayed for the man to be exonerated, which is a strange thing to pray for. If you think about it, you should pray for justice. You should pray for truth, not necessarily for one outcome, but that's already an interesting idea. So the other explanation was that just as a korban expiates, the death of a righteous person could be an expiation in its own right. And I gave the counter example of the death of Stalin releasing everybody from the gulag because they were there for no reason. And this would be kind of the utter opposite, lahavdil, as we would say, elef alfei havdalos, viribe rivavos. So the question is, when the person is in the City of Refuge, can he leave for anything? Can he leave, you know, for a family wedding? Can he leave, you know, for some important diplomatic mission? And the answer is a categorical no. Eno yotze lo le'edos mitzvah, he cannot be released from the City of Refuge to testify in the context of a mitzvah, v'lo le'edos mamon, and not for financial matters, v'lo le'edos nefashos, even if his testimony is required in a capital case. V'afilu Yisrael tzrichin lo, v'afilu sar tzva Yisrael ki yoiv ben Tzruya, eno yotze misham lo'olam. Even if it's a matter of national security, Yoav ben Tzruya was the sar tzva, he was the chief of staff of David HaMelech's army. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Asher Nos Shama, Sham Tehe Diraso, he has to live in the Eir Miklat, Sham Tehe Misaso, there he shall die, unless the Kohen Gadol predeceases him, Sham Tehe Kivuraso, and there he is buried. He's not even released upon death. The Rambam notes that when the Kohen Gadol dies, the bones can be moved into the family burial plot, into the Kever Avos. Now, the Mishnah moves from here to discuss a very important principle. We have something in Halacha, it applies in many areas of Halacha. For example, in Hilchos Shabbos, called Tchum, but it's a particular significance with respect to the Arei Miklat. The Arei Miklat had fields around them, Tchum, that extended, and there's a machlokas, a very large machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban and the Rashbam, how exactly the fields were set up, but basically 2,000 amos surrounding the Eir Miklat is called the Tchum of the Eir Miklat. So once you reach to 2,000 amos, which is a mil in Halacha, the amount of the distance that takes 18 minutes to walk, Kishem Sha'ir Koletes Kach Tchuma Shal'ir Kolet. So too does the 2,000 amos, approximately 3,000 feet or 6/10 of a mile outside the perimeter of the city, so too it absorbs. Now, let's say you have an individual who says, you know what, I don't want to live in the Eir Miklat anymore. I'm prepared to risk it. So he leaves the City of Refuge bemazed with intentionality, knowing that, of course, he's endangering himself. So Rotzeach Sheyatza Chutz L'Tchum, Itzo Goel Hadam, and the avenger of the blood from the family happens to find the Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer Mitzvah Biyad Goel Hadam. It's in fact a mitzvah for the Goel Adam to kill such a person because this person is defying the sentence that's been imposed upon him. He apparently doesn't take seriously the idea that he committed an accidental murder and therefore has to sustain the consequences of that. And not only can the Goel Adam have the mitzvah of killing him, but Rishus Biad Kol Adam. That means if Sigi, who's not the Goel Adam, would find the Rotzeach Bishgaga, the accidental murderer, who wantonly left the city, so Sigi would have the right, would have the license to kill him. Now you'd say, what's the connection between somebody who's not a member of the family and the accidental murderer? And the answer is because, you know, as the Torah says many times, that when there's bloodshed, velo sachanifu es haaretz, in a certain sense corrupts the entire land. So just like we have a concept of a citizen's arrest, you know, it's a good thing to do to make sure that the accidental murderer isn't just going free. Rabbi Akiva Omer, he doesn't take things that far. He says the Goel Hadam has license, but not a mitzvah. He has reshus to kill this particular individual, the Rotzeach Vishgaga, who lives the Eir Miklat B'meiza, the accidental murderer who leaves the city of refuge intentionally and knowingly. V'chol adam ein chayavin alav. Not that there's a license for an individual who's not a member of the family to kill him, but if he does so, he would not be held responsible for murder. Now, we get into another very interesting halacha, which is, let's say you're at the boundary of the Tchum. So we're pushing things out slowly but surely. So you have the city of refuge, then you have the Tchum, you have the 2,000 amos, the 3,000 feet outside the city, and now you could have an even a little bit more than that. So there's something called an ilan sheyesh lo nof, a tree that has certain branches. So the Mishnah is very generous, and the halacha is very generous in terms of extending outwards the boundary of the Eir Miklat. So ilan sheyesh lo nof besocha tchum, venofo nota chutz tchum, o omid chutz tchum, venofo nota latocha tchum, hakol holech achar hanof. So even the language of the Mishnah suggests that, okay, wherever the nof is, wherever the overhang is, that should be dispositive. The Gemara actually amends the Mishnah to say, HaKol Holech Af Achar Hanof, which means the following. So let's say you have a large tree that's within the boundary, and it has branches that go 5, 10, 15, 20 feet outside of the boundary surrounding the Eir Miklat. So since the actual trunk of the tree is within the boundary of the Eir Miklat, so once the accidental murderer reaches 20 feet beyond that, now he's under the branches, that's sufficient because the tree, the branches of the tree are attached to the actual trunk of the tree. Now, what about the opposite scenario? Let's say the trunk of the tree happens to be, you know, 20, 25 feet outside the boundary of the Tchum, which itself is about 6 tenths of a mile outside of the Eir Miklat, but the branches of that tree extend into the Tchum. So you would think, okay, well, if you want to be consistent about it, here the trunk is, of course, outside the boundary, and so that tree should not be able to bridge you into the city of refuge. But the opposite is true, that we're always lenient in these cases, and we say that because the nof, the branches, in this case, extend into the boundary itself, we're willing to be lenient. And again, this is not an accident. This reflects, you know, the halacha's disposition towards leniency, and we saw this in many different ways. When we studied Masechta Sanhedrin, remember, that's how we got to Makos in the first place, according to the view that Sanhedrin and Makos used to be attached. And we talked about, if you want to convict somebody, you have to have a majority of at least two, which in practice basically means a majority of three, a 13 to 10 majority on a Sanhedrin Kitana. If you want to, you know, exonerate somebody, all you need is a majority of one, 12 to 11, and many other distinctions that we saw, all militating in favor of exoneration, because, you know, we have a kind of a humanistic approach to this, and that's where the Mishnah discussed at the end of the first parak that a court that adjudicated even a capital case once every 70 years was held as a based in Chavlanis as a very violent kind of a court. And Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Tarfon came along and said, once every 70 years, how about never? Never would we want to convict anybody. And had they been serving on the high court at the time when it was adjudicating capital cases, they would have ensured that no such thing took place. Now, here's a really interesting last two cases in the Mishnah. Let's say you have an accidental murderer who commits accidental murder while he's in the Eir Miklat. So he's a double accidental murderer. So he's already been exiled into the city of refuge, and he can't go anywhere. As we said, he's not even allowed to leave if the entire Jewish nation depends, you know, on him for some very important task. So what happens? He's exiled from one neighborhood to the other. You know, so let's say Tinek happened to be a city of refuge. You'd have to go to the other side of town, and he wouldn't then be able to leave that other side of town. So his boundaries would become more narrowed. So Harag Ba'osa'ir, Golem Yishchuna L'shchuna. Okay, remember we mentioned that there were 48 cities of the Levim. 6 of the Levite cities were designated as cities of refuge, leaving a remainder of 42, which could be used as cities of refuge, but there are two distinctions that we keep on referring to. So first of all, if you want to go to one of those other 42 cities of refuge, you have to have clear intentionality that I am going here because I am seeking asylum, number one, versus the other 6, which just happen to absorb, even if you don't happen to know that they're cities of refuge. And number two, you have to pay rent to the Levium who live there, as opposed to the 6 cities of refuge, which were created for the residents of accidental murderers, and therefore there would be no rent. So Ben Levi, let's say a Levi who lives in one of the 42 cities happens to commit an accidental murder. So the Mishnah says, Gola Meir Leir, that he would actually have to go to a different city, even though he could say, well, I already live in a city of refuge. And the idea, I think, is pretty clear, because the rear is supposed to be some kind of a penalty associated with it, to say, oh, well, hey, look, I live in a city of refuge, so I guess I don't have to worry about anything. The Avenger of the Blood can't get to me over here. And, let's say I'm the landlord, so, you know, I don't have to pay, I can pay rent to myself or whatever it is. So that's not going to fly because, after all, there has to be some kind of an expiation here. And the only way that there can be an expiation, if there's some sense of a consequence, if the individual happens to be a Levi who commits an accidental murder and he already lives in a city of refuge, so he would have to go to a different city. Because otherwise there's really no consequence associated with accidental murder. And again, there has to be a consequence. We're not treating this person as an intentional murderer, but at the same time, we have to hold this person responsible to some degree, and that's the notion of the Ir Miklat. So again, Judaism does not really have any concept of incarceration. Judaism did not perceive as incarcerating people for lengthy periods of time with other criminals as having some, rehabilitating capacity. And that's obviously a very fascinating thing to think about. And as we live in a country with over 2 million people who are incarcerated, and there's a lot of bipartisan consensus around reform in that area. But this is probably the closest you get in the halachic system to the notion of incarceration, where a person, again, is not held in a, you know, jail facility and he's, you know, not surrounded by, you know, criminals, but the person is confined, in essence, to a particular space. He loses some freedom of movement, and that is indeed a penalty. People certainly wouldn't sign up for this just for fun. So within reason, it sort of establishes some limits on the person's freedom of movement. So tomorrow we're going to talk about, you know, how much is this associated with stigmatization. You know, Florida in the past previous election just passed a law saying that nonviolent felons should have their voting rights restored. You know, and it passed overwhelmingly in the state of Florida, which is a relatively conservative state. So the question is, you know, how much does being an accidental murderer stigmatize you? Let's say, you know, you go to one of these cities of refuge and you join, you know, the shul, you know, the, let's say one of the cities was Hebron. So you see the young Israel of Hebron or the young Israel of Shechem or the young Israel of Kadesh. These are all cities of refuge, and they want to make you the president. You're doing such a great job, and they want to honor you at the dinner. You know, is this mutter? Can you accept such an honor? Or do you have to say, look, I'm here, you know, as part of an accidental murderer program, and, you know, therefore, you know, they say, no, that's why you deserve. You have to go through the honor. You know, it's part of the penalty. But assuming you don't take that perspective, so that's what the Mishnah tomorrow night is going to discuss, is, you know, how much do we stigmatize the individual, and how much do we say the exile is punishment enough? We're not looking to crush this person, and we want to be able to, you know, give them some degree of humanity. So that becomes a really fascinating discussion to have. You know, it has to do with the notion of stigmatizing somebody who does this, and or how much is it about just, you know, an exile, and that's punishment in its own right. So that's what we'll cover tomorrow. Rabbi Chanan ben Akasha, Maratz Kadosh Baruch Hu, Zakos Yisrael.